President Trump's hardline tactics on trade with China, putting a million jobs on the line. China's richest man, Jack Ma, telling Chinese state-owned news agency Xinhua, America can kiss his pledge to create a million jobs in the U.S. goodbye. According to a translation, Ma, the billionaire founder of Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba, said Wednesday, quote, the promise was made on the premise of friendly U.S.-China partnership and rational trade relations. That premise no longer exists today, so our promise cannot be fulfilled.
Volkswagen's iconic Beetle is getting squashed as the carmaker dumps the past in favor of a greener electric future. The model was given a turn-of-the-century revival for millennials, but its popularity, along with most other small cars, has been in steady decline.
Google clinching a major win this week in the race to power your car's infotainment system, an alliance of Renault, Nissan, and Mitsubishi, which together sold over 10 million vehicles last year, saying future models will integrate maps and the voice-operated butler, Google Assistant. A clear departure from when car makers tried to build in their own systems, fearing leaning on big tech could let Silicon Valley have the upper hand in relationships with its customers.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Thursday. It's September 20th, and it's 5:10 in the morning. Thank you again for being with us for today's edition of The Opening Bell and another business day getting underway. We have a great show for you lined up today. In addition to the overnight intel from the business world, it is Thought Leader Thursday here on the program, and Wayne Janis is with us. You know, a lot of people have issues talking about money, whether it's because of pride or because they just don't want to share those details. But we're going to talk to Wayne today about why it is important for wealth building to actually be able to talk about your finances, at least with the financial advisor. So Wayne will be in our first segment this morning. Also coming up a little bit later on in the program, a new book out called Billion Dollar Whale about a man named Joe Lowe, a social climber who pulled off one of the biggest heists in history right under the nose of the global financial industry. We're going to have the authors of the book with us at about 5:40 this morning, and there's a big update on this story this morning with arrests in Malaysia to this story. So that'll be coming up a little bit later in the program. First, though, on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing toward opening gains later on Wall Street, with Dow futures up 32 points. NASDAQ and S&P futures are pointing higher as well, but leaning more to the flat category this morning. Around the globe, markets in Europe are generally higher, with the FTSE, the DAX, and the CAC all up between 0.25% and 0.5%. And in Asia this morning, markets are just a little bit higher as well. The Nikkei up just a fraction, the Hang Seng up about 0.25%, and oil this morning at, 71.55 a barrel. That's up about 0.5%, 43 cents. We're watching a couple of stories for you this morning. First, the story involving the financial markets and trade. The U.S. and Canada negotiators facing a deadline at the end of this month say they will now extend until at least today their negotiations to keep Canada in the North American trade bloc. After a second meeting of the day yesterday with the U.S. Trade Representative, Canada's Minister of Foreign Affairs told reporters they plan to keep on talking today. She says the officials have more work to do, will continue to work this evening. The U.S. has also agreed to those talks. President Trump began negotiations last year to revamp the North American Free Trade Agreement with Canada and Mexico. The U.S. and Mexico reached a preliminary deal last month. There is news this morning regarding the takeover of the Sky Network in London, in Europe. British regulators say that the corporate battle between 21st Century Fox and Comcast to take over Sky will be settled by auction. The takeover panel, an independent regulator, says that since neither company has declared its final offer final, an auction procedure is expected to commence on September 21st. Comcast has put down almost a $34 billion offer for Sky. Fox has bid a little bit less than that for the 61% share of the satellite broadcaster called Sky. We begin front and center this morning with our thought leader conversation, and Wayne Janis is here this morning Wayne is the president of the financial planning practice at Whitnell, an affiliate of Associated Bank. Lots to cover this morning about financial planning and money. Wayne, good morning. Welcome back to the opening bell.
Good morning, Steve. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing very well. It's nice to see you again. I have lots of questions about money this morning, and you're our expert on this. First of all, I want to talk to you about just why some people find it so hard to talk about money. Is it because it's just confusing or it's too private or they don't understand what's going on? Why would you say that is?
It is very personal. It's kind of, for men, it's almost a measuring stick of whether you're doing a good job to your family, and it's very private. You don't want people to know because you don't want them to judge you because you're spending more money than you should, or that maybe you should be picking up the tab more often because you got all this money sitting in the bank.
Right.
And so people don't want to know what they have because they don't want to have to change their behavior based upon your judgment of them.
Yeah, my stamp collecting is a little out of control. I'm going to admit that right now. I've been spending a little too much on that. But isn't it dangerous to not have this conversation with about money in some cases? Like, especially if you're working for me and I'm your client, I need to talk to you and be honest and open about my money, don't I?
Yeah, I think if you're working with an advisor, and it's an independent advisor who's not selling something, life insurance or an annuity or a mutual fund. If you have somebody that's actually advising you, they have an expertise that is beyond yours. Plus, you've got a job, and so your focus is on your job. You got a family. You've got things you're doing. You don't have the time to spend to understand all the things that may impact your financial situation. So, getting to an expert, and the key is the expert. You have to be talking to people that are experts. And what does a financial person have to be an expert in? Taxes, insurance, investments, estate planning and how title passes, powers of attorney for medical care. It runs the gamut of so many things. And so not every advisor can speak intelligently about those things. But if you deal with experienced advisors, they know when they don't know something and they know who to bring into the team if you need to worry about powers of attorney for medical care and how to get them.
You just hit on some very important things that an advisor should know. How do we know if we've got a good advisor? Are there things that we can ask them if they don't offer up that you've just said? How do we know?
Well, there's a lot of, you've got the CFP, the Financial Planners Organization. You've got accounting firms, CPA organizations that have groupings of people that do financial planning for clients. And so one way is to check their credentials. What are they? Are they a CPA? Are they a lawyer? Do they have a master's in tax? Are they a certified financial planner? What is their background? What is their experience? And I think the most important one to ask is, if I listen to you and I follow your advice, how do you get paid?
Yeah.
Do I write you a check and pay you for your time?
Mm-hmm.
Or have you just convinced me I should buy a whole life insurance policy that's going to pay you a 20% commission? So understanding not only how you get paid, but how much you're going to get paid if I follow your advice, I think I'd make that the number one axiom if you're talking with people who are using advisor. Know what happens if you give them money to invest in something, how much of it goes to them.
My biggest fear is giving a lot of money up front, paying a lot of money up front to an advisor before any work is done at all. That's always one of my biggest fears. Do other people share that concern, or is that generally how it's done?
I haven't had that experience because we don't do that. We don't say, okay, we're going to charge you $5,000 to put together a total financial plan. What we typically do is we say, we're going to charge you $1,200 a quarter,
okay,
to do the plan. And generally speaking, most of the labor component is in the front half of that because you're meeting, you're putting together things, getting data. And so generally speaking, we've put in the time that exceeds that $5,000 even before all of the checks have been written.
I saw an article recently about, back to the question of, you know, asking questions about money and talking to your advisor, that one of the most common questions is, am I normal? Is my situation normal? How does it compare to others? Do you agree with that, or do you find other questions are more common?
I can't say that I get that a lot.
Yeah.
You know, people might say, am I spending too much money? But, you know, that's arithmetic. Because if you're talking about whether they're spending too much money or are they providing for the future properly, are they putting money in the right places so the kids can go to college without incurring a $300,000 student loan, it's all about behavior now and modifying instant gratification for future gratification so the kids can go to college. So you can retire at 55 and not 95.
Right.
So when we talk to people about what's normal, what we talk about is what's normal to you is you have objectives. And you're not going to attain those objectives if you spend every penny you make now. And any of those future objectives, if they constantly get pushed to the back of the room, then you're not going to meet your objectives, and you will be working until you're 95. Yeah.
It almost sounds like when you start an exercise program, they tell you no pain, no gain. You got to put in the pain to get the gain, right?
Yes. Yeah. You know, the clients that they do, and that isn't to say that you have to squirrel away all your money and live like a hermit. It's all about balance.
Yeah.
You know, balancing, and the first thing that you want them to give up on isn't necessarily the putting 10% of their income into a savings plan. Maybe it's cutting back on how much you're going to spend on your vacation, or maybe putting off buying a new car for another year. The first thing that gets cut for people that are unsuccessful is savings. Everything else stays there. We got to go on vacation. We got to buy that new car. We got, you know, and if they don't change that behavior and they use reducing savings or eliminating savings as always their option, what do you think the result's going to be?
Yeah, I think we all know the answer to that one. Wayne, I want to hit some topics this morning while you're here. Got a couple of questions. Let's talk about insurance. What are the right kinds of insurance that we should have that you tell your clients to make sure that they have?
There's all kinds of insurance. You know, there's liability insurance, umbrella insurance, there's medical insurance, there's life insurance and disability insurance. I think it's kind of a subject we could talk about for an hour, but I'd like to focus on two areas where I see the things that trouble me the most for young people, and where I have three young sons, and having them understand how to protect their families properly. And so if you have a family and you're in your 30s, you got a wife, and whether she works or not, or whether it's the wife that's working or the husband that's the stay-at-home parent, mm-hmm. or working part-time, you've got a lot of obligations, mortgage, rent, trying to raise these kids, and there's a fear if I die, who's going to make up my $60,000 paycheck? And so they go to get insurance. And because whole life insurance is so much more profitable to sell than term insurance, most people I see end up going with the whole life insurance. And to give you an example of how that works, I had one of my contacts in insurance run some numbers for me, and I said, for the 33-year-old guy with a couple of kids and a wife who's in good health, what would it cost him to get $1 million of life insurance for 20 years? So when he's 51, the kids are through college, and he's getting closer to retirement, so he may not need it then. What is it going to cost him for the next 20 years for that $1 million of coverage? $500 a year.
Wow.
For a million.
That's.
How much would I get for that same price in a whole life insurance?
$50,000. Wow.
You die at $50,000, you haven't even covered 1 year's income for your family.
Yeah.
But that's what most people buy because they don't get – they're buying from somebody that says they're an advisor that's really just selling an expensive product. So the other thing that people worry about, they worry about the dying and they try to do what's right there. But when you're 31, 32 years old, my kids, they like to ski. They like to do water skiing. They're active. And I said, yeah, I've got a half a dozen or more clients who are disabled. They all have disability insurance. And for you that are 30, 35 years old, you're 10 times more likely in the next 20 years to become disabled rather than die. The only way your family gets money is if you die. If you have no disability insurance, you're still alive. You're still being fed. Maybe you need more care. And if there's no disability insurance, poof. Yeah. Most companies offer disability insurance. And they allow you even to buy more disability insurance than the number that they give you. And that is something people don't talk about. Think about life, but they don't. you're 10 times more likely to become disabled, yeah. And they talk about life insurance.
Yeah, it seems like, that, you know, I know we talk a lot about investments like stocks and other things. That seems like a really smart investment is to have that insurance in place.
And it's cheap.
Yeah.
And the reason that people say, how can that be possible that some insurance company, Prudential, is going to give me $1 million of insurance for $500 a year? And the answer is, most of those policies, because they're young people take them out, 30 years old, by the time the 15 or 20 years is up, because the premium is guaranteed for 20 years, at the end of the 20 years, the premium doesn't go from 500 to 600, it goes to 12,000. So 90% of those policies lapse. So all the premiums that are collected by the insurance company for all those people, they never pay out on them. That's how they can keep the overall price down and why term insurance is very cheap. Now, if you're a wealthy person and you don't necessarily need insurance, but the income tax laws favor insurance and the estate tax laws favor insurance. So buying insurance where all of the income and all the gains can come out free from income tax and estate tax for wealthy families is something that most families in the multi-million dollar category use, not necessarily for the death benefit, but for the economics of the insurance and the tax effect. Because if the money is free of federal tax and state tax and estate tax and Illinois estate tax, you're talking about some huge numbers of being able to pass wealth on to the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a different kind of life insurance than what I'm talking about, is protecting my family if I'm 31 years old and I got three kids and I'm making $60,000 a year. And if I die, Who's going to come up with the $60,000?
Another real life scenario question: should I repay my credit card debt or invest in my 401k plan? What do you say here?
Credit card debt is a real monkey on your back. For people that have it's diabolical. It just eats you up because interest rates could be 20%, 25%, 28%, and so it's something that I've always preached to my kids to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say you have it. You got this credit card debt. But you also work for a company that will allow you to invest in their 401k plan, and they match it 100% up to the first 6% of your income. So let's say that you have somebody that makes $100,000, and they pay off $6,000 of their charge card. At 25%, whatever the rate, they've saved $1,500.
Mm-hmm.
Right? 25% of 6,000. So, and that's phenomenal because of that. That's also a non-deductible $1,500. On the other hand, if instead of doing that, they give the money to their employer and put it into a 401k plan, And the company matches it 100%. Well, now instead of making $1,500 in saved interest, you just made $6,000. On top of that, in your tax bracket, you're going to save another $2,000 in federal and state tax. So the $6,000 going into the 401k plan saved you $8,000 versus $1,500. That's a huge difference to not take advantage of. Plus, the money that you put into a 401k plan, you deduct it from your Illinois tax. When you ultimately you take it out of the 401k plan, you don't pay Illinois tax on it, at least under current law. It's tax-free. Deductible going in, free coming out. And so the power of putting money into the 401k where it's matched, if it's not matched, then you're dealing with a different scenario because then credit card debt starts to look a little more attractive.
There's
the first option of being paid off.
Sure. There's another question I want to get to, too. It's one that I think a lot of people are impacted by. We hear a lot about student loan debt these days. So what if I'm engaged to be married to somebody who has $200,000 in student loan debt? Should I just call it off and move on to the next person?
Well, how much student loan debt do you have?
I have zero. Let's say I have zero.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you had $300,000, you'd say, well, we have $500,000 together.
Right. But let's say I have zero and they have $200,000.
Yeah, I work with some attorneys, a couple in particular that are friends of mine. I've been working with them a long time, and they're involved in divorce litigation. And the statistics are very high. One of the major major sources of broken marriages is money. Financial problems, you can't pay the bills, you're trying to pay off the debt, and at the same time, you want to buy or rent a house, you want to have a family, and the fact that you have that debt there impedes your ability to get attractively priced car loans, attractively priced mortgages, and so it puts a pressure on the relationship. I'm not saying that love won't overcome, but I think it's, you can't just go into it blindly and think that it's just going to go away by itself.
Right.
Well, if the person that you has the $200,000 of student loan is a surgeon who's going to be making $500,000 a year, that's not a problem. But I have one client of mine who paid his daughter's education off, struggled, and she had no debt, and she married a guy who's a musician. And he was a wonderful musician, but he's making $30,000 a year with a $300,000 student loan debt. They can't buy a car.
Yeah.
They can't buy a house, and they're putting off having kids. Those all put pressure on the relationship, and so go into it with your eyes wide open. Don't think this thing is going to just poof, go away.
And if you get divorced, you split that, don't you? You split paying that back, right?
And my divorce lawyer also said, you know, if you, you know, it's very difficult to have a prenuptial agreement, but he said, you know, when if you got that kind of a disparity, if somebody's got this debt, it's probably a good idea to set up a program where if you do get divorced, it's clear that that obligation goes with the person that ran it up.
Yeah.
And then you don't end up sharing in it. Or if you used marital money to pay down that debt, that is part of the marital settlement, you get it back because you paid off his or her debt.
Oh, okay. You know, we talk about it being hard to talk about money with your financial advisor. I can't imagine talking to a fiance about money and having this discussion. It would be pretty sticky, I think.
I got to tell you, it's I've seen it break up more than one engagement.
Wow.
Because you're planning a divorce. The prenuptial, and when you get to the lawyers who really put it out there, and it is so cold and there's no feeling to the agreement. It's a contract that says, we get divorced, you get this. If we're married for 3 years, we'll give you more money. So there's an earn-out period if you're married longer. And, you know, you start talking about these things, it is, and that's probably why people don't typically hire their divorce lawyers or prenuptial lawyers to do any work after that, because it puts a real wedge. You know, for better or for worse, until death do us part, but not with my money.
Exactly. Wayne, great conversation this morning. How can people get a hold of you if they want to have a personal conversation about all this?
Well, I'm with Whitnell, WJANUS at Whitnell, WHITNELL.com.
We'll see you again next time.
Good. Great talking to you.
Wayne Janis is the president of the financial planning practice at Whitnell, an affiliate of Associated Bank. He's our thought leader today. Remember, you can hear thought leader conversations every Thursday here on the Opening Bell. And follow more of their conversations over at associatedbank.com/thought leadership. And follow Associated Bank on Twitter at Associated Biz. We're going to continue our conversation with Wayne after the bell this morning, and we'll post that in the podcast of the broadcast a little bit later on this morning.
Hi, this is Catherine Davis, today's NO Minute on WGN Radio, a rundown of all the Chicago innovation and tech news you need to know, delivered by ChicagoNO.com. Northbrook-based Crate & Barrel has partnered with Zola, a New York-based wedding planning startup that's raised more than $140 million in venture capital funding. Through the deal, Zola users will be able to shop an exclusive wedding registry comprised of Crate & Barrel merchandise. WeWork reached a settlement agreement with authorities in Illinois and New York to stop using overly broad non-compete agreements for most of its employees, releasing 1,400 of them from the agreements that prohibited them from taking jobs with competitors. That's today's NO Minute from WGN Radio. Learn more at ChicagoNO.com and sign up for The Beat, our daily email newsletter.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is the Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Thursday edition of the Opening Bell. In 2009, a man named Joe Lowe, a young social climber, pulled off one of the biggest heists in history right under the nose of the global financial industry and right in the shadow of the 2008 financial crisis. Tom Wright and Bradley Hope are staff reporters at the Wall Street Journal, and they've written a new book called A Billion Dollar Whale, The Man Who Fooled Wall Street,
Hollywood and the World. And both authors are with us this morning. Tom and Bradley, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Thank you very much.
Good having you this morning. A Billion Dollar Whale, good book about a story that has been fascinating to follow all along. You guys have been covering it from the beginning. Tell our listeners what you've written about here.
Basically, it's the story of one of the great financial heists maybe ever has ever taken place. It has to do with a Malaysian guy called Joe Low, who managed to convince the Prime Minister of Malaysia to set up this sovereign wealth fund, and over the period of just a few years managed to siphon away billions of dollars that he used to amass a Hollywood empire, help produce the film The Wolf of Wall Street, buy artwork, spend time with celebrities like Leonardo DiCaprio, and even get close to American political power.
It was an amazing story because it happened so close to the start of the financial crisis. That's a big part of the story, too, isn't it, that this was able to be perpetrated so close to all of that happening?
Well, I think Joe Low came into play at the time of the financial crisis, right? The big banks in the U.S. were looking for ways to make money. Markets were not good in the U.S. And he managed to get close to Goldman Sachs bankers and persuaded them to help the fund that he was involved with, a fund called 1MDB, a Malaysian sovereign wealth fund, to raise money. And it was very easy for them to raise money at that time. Global interest rates were very low. And they went out with Goldman Sachs' help, and they raised $6.5 billion in bonds. And then Jello basically just took that and funneled it into offshore accounts and used it to do all this crazy spending. But there was some internal dissension at Goldman Sachs about whether they should be doing business with this fund. There were some red flags. You know, what was his fund's raison d'etre? Who was this Joe Low guy? He was only 27 at the time. But it had the backing of very powerful figures inside Goldman, including Gary Cohen. And that all does feed into the global crisis, like you were saying, the subprime crisis, because Goldman was looking for other ways to make money.
Goldman is a good part of the story. Is there an allegation here that they did something that they shouldn't have done, or was it that they just made a mistake in dealing with this guy?
There's no formal allegations against Goldman Sachs as a bank right now, but what's emerged over the last couple of years is that they were heavily involved with this fund, and there was a lot of red flags. It was not just the case of one, you know, kind of a rogue banker. There was just a lot of things that don't make a lot of sense, especially looking back on it now. One example in particular is that after this 1MDB fund had already raised a $3.5 billion bond, the Prime Minister of Malaysia sort of sidled up to a senior Goldman executive in Davos and said, "I need another $3 billion quickly and quietly," essentially. And then when that money was raised, just the same as the other one, it was the request from 1MDB was for the money to be deposited in this very small Swiss bank that didn't really have a reputation for doing major, you know, commercial transactions. It was more of a private wealth bank. And so I think those are the kinds of things that are under investigation by the Justice Department and other regulators.
When you look up the words hubris and greed, there's going to be a picture of this guy, I'm guessing. Talk to us about some of the excesses that he spent some of this money on.
Well, in 2009, which is when he first got his hands on some of the early cash from this scam, he went out and bought Hollywood celebrities. He wanted to get to know, you know, some of the sort of best known people. He was fixated with Paris Hilton. He paid her a lot of money to sort of hang out with him and attend events. And he wanted to build a Hollywood empire. He got to know Leonardo DiCaprio and hosted in late 2009 a party in the Palazzo Hotel in Vegas with 22 or 23 playmates and Leonardo DiCaprio. And the way that he operated was to throw money around to create this idea that he was a real player in the entertainment industry. And we open our book with an epilogue, with a prologue, sorry, which was Joe Low's birthday party in 2012, which, you know, Robin Leach, the veteran entertainment watcher, said was probably the biggest ever private party held. It was just insane in a hangar just off the strip in Vegas, had Britney Spears bursting out of a birthday cake, had, you know, probably more celebrities than you'd get at any function apart from the Oscars. And this was the kind of thing that he would regularly do, and it helped him to to build contacts with other business people who he would invite to these events. So he was a real genius of throwing money around and putting himself at the center of the action, which allowed him to do more deals.
And amazingly, the story intersects with the movie The Wolf of Wall Street. I think our listeners are probably pretty familiar with that movie. Talk to us about that connection between Joe Lowe and that movie.
So one of the first things he wanted to do to get closer to these Hollywood stars was to become a film financier. And so together with the stepson of the Prime Minister of Malaysia and this other gentleman called Joey McFarland, they created this company called Red Granite Pictures. And that company, its first film was a bit smaller, but when they discovered that there was this great need in Hollywood for sort of less thoughtful spending of money on films. And so Leonardo DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese had wanted to make the film The Wolf of Wall Street for years, but they'd been sort of rebuffed by the big studios who were afraid that it was a little bit extreme. It was going to be just shy of an X-rated film the way it had been written. But along came Joe Lowe and this group, and they said, listen, we'll fund it. We'll fund it at the full cost, I think about $100 million, which is a high budget for a film like that. So that was and turned out to be actually a wildly successful film. And of course, none of that money was returned to Malaysia, even though the money to film it had actually came from that fund, 1MDB.
What is the lasting legacy going to be, do you think, of 1MDB and Joe Lowe here? Has this changed the way investigations into financial crimes are being done? And what lessons do we learn?
Well, you know, the big disappointment after the financial crisis was that nobody paid for the financial malfeasance that went on. Not one Wall Street banker went to jail, or I think maybe a low-level Credit Suisse banker went to jail. So the big question now, this story hasn't ended. Joe Lowe's still on the run in China. The Department of Justice criminal investigation is still ongoing, including into a Goldman Sachs former partner called Tim Leissner, who is in plea deal talks with them and knew Joe Lowe very well. We will have to wait to see whether anyone goes to jail for this, because the recent history of Wall Street has been that banks sign deferred prosecution agreements where they don't really admit guilt. They pay a big fine. You know, that happened with Bernie Madoff and J.P. Morgan, where Bernie Madoff's account was, they paid a fine of $2 billion. And these, you know, people say these are the cost of doing business for these banks. As the writers of this book, Billion Dollar Whale, we hope that this will be a test case for the investigations into white collar crime, and that it will set down a standard that you can't just get away with doing this kind of thing. There are consequences.
Joe Lowe has actually reached out to you via website and responded to your book. I'm curious what you think about what he said here, and also the fact that nobody can apparently arrest him, but here he is on this website.
Yeah, I think, you know, he hasn't ever addressed any of the allegations made against him or any of the things that have been outlined in these, like, you know, hundreds of pages of DOJ filings. But he has started in the last year to give out just a blanket statement about maintaining his innocence. And more recently, he started talking about how there's nowhere on earth that he can get a fair trial, so he won't submit to any jurisdiction, which is, so that kind of explains a little bit of why he's at large in China, as at least that's what we believe. And there's not really an extradition arrangement between China and Malaysia. And it's kind of unclear under what terms he's in China. We've reported in the Wall Street Journal that he's sort of told people that he's been working with Chinese intelligence and that he has very strong relationships there. So, I mean, the way we see his comments so far is that we still would rather go through it in detail rather than just hearing a sort of blanket maintaining of innocence.
As folks read this book, what would you hope that their takeaway is?
From reading Billion Dollar Whale, well, you know, I don't want to belabor the point about white collar crime. I think first and foremost, this is a true crime thriller. You know, it's a fun read. It's a crazy story. I mean, what Joe Lowe achieved in just some short years is beyond belief. The way he was able to get himself into these elite circles, but also a sense of anger about how compliance in the financial world has totally failed everybody in the last few years, not just the financial crisis, but, you know, here again with this story.
Gentlemen, all the best with your book. Thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Tom Ryan and Bradley Hope, staff reporters at The Wall Street Journal. and authors of Billion Dollar Whale, The Man Who Fooled Wall Street, Hollywood, and the World, from Hatchet Publishing. There's an update on this story. Malaysia's former leader has been hit with 25 new charges of corruption and money laundering linked to the 1MDB scandal, including allegations that hundreds of millions of dollars were transferred to his personal bank account. He has denied those charges during a court appearance in Kuala Lumpur, but these are the latest in charges that have brought at least two arrests previously, a total of 21 money laundering charges, four corruption charges, these major steps in bringing him to justice, according to reports out of Malaysia. Connected to the 1MDB scandal and the Billion Dollar Whale.
You're listening to the Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
The WGN Associated Bank Market Desk looking for a flat to a positive open on Wall Street a little bit later on this morning. Dow, NASDAQ, S&P futures are up just less than a quarter of a percent this morning each. We will have the latest on the markets throughout the morning here on 720 WGN, all the way up until the opening bell and beyond. Let's get the latest on agriculture, commodities now. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Guess what? It rained in the desert. We got a little bit of rain in the desert. Not much for this time of the year, but it did rain. Pretty good showers in Arizona, where they don't grow much corn or soybeans. Let's look to South America. Soybean planting getting underway after their starting date of September 15th. Farmers in Brazil cannot plant soybeans before September 15th, a measure adopted each year to reduce the soy rust outbreaks. But they are reporting favorable weather conditions and better progress on planting than last year. Now, in the U.S., the American Soybean Association will continue to lobby Washington to negotiate a solution to end the escalating trade war between China and the United States. That statement made at an industry conference yesterday by the president of the American Soybean Association, John Helsdorfer. And trade dispute has been a bad situation for both of us, he said in his presentation. The Soybean Association will continue to ask the administration to find a way to work together again. As far as the grain market in the overnight trade, starting a few hours ago, most active soybean futures contract down to $8.29 after firming 2% yesterday. Soybeans, though, on Tuesday hit their lowest since December of 2008 at $8.12 a bushel. The final day of the Ohio Farm Science Review today, and we hope you have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You as well. A couple of stories before we leave you this morning. Crane Chicago Business reporting that Chicago-based United Airlines has had discussions in recent months with developers to possibly move its headquarters out of Willis Tower. They're looking at several apparent places. It's coming ahead of their 2023 lease termination. That's when it expires. United, according to Cranes, would have to execute an option to leave at least 2 years in advance. The story suggests that United just may be testing the waters or maybe even trying to gain some leverage for a deal at Willis Tower. Also, Walmart has asked the Trump administration to walk back its plan to put tariffs on Christmas lights, shampoo, dog food, luggage, mattresses, handbags, backpacks, vacuum cleaners, bicycles, cooking grills, cable cords, air conditioners, the list goes on. But apparently the White House has said no to Walmart. The company says the latest round of tariffs will mean price hikes on average consumers and Walmart customers, along with American businesses and manufacturers. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for Thursday, September 20th. Jobless claims, initial jobless claims are due this morning. Also, the Philadelphia Fed Business Outlook Survey, a report on existing home sales, the leading economic indicators out, the EIA natural gas report. We'll get a look at the Fed balance sheet and a money supply report as well. Earnings today from a couple of big companies, including Darden Restaurants And we'll be watching closely because it was on our stock picker segment yesterday. Micron Technology reporting quarterly earnings as well today. Just some of the things that could move the markets on this Thursday, September the 20th.